This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, what one of the most dangerous paths to America really looks like. Last December, a Venezuelan couple and their two children, ages 2 and 8, set out to travel to the United States on foot. The night before they were about to enter the jungle, the father, Burkhan, started having second thoughts.
Burkhan was pacing and questioning himself. You know, what if this happens? What if that happens? What if one of the children is bit by a snake? What if one of them gets a fever?
Burkhan and his family were about to cross the Darien Gap, one of the most dangerous migration routes in the world. It begins in Colombia and stretches about 70 miles north into Panama. It's the only way to get from South to Central America by land, and it cuts through dense jungle, rocky climbs, and rushing rivers. On their first day of the trek, the family struggled. Burkhan was carrying his 2-year-old son on his shoulders.
He was shaking from both exhaustion and fear, I think. I mean, at one point, his face was almost purple in color. And, you know, we thought a number of times that he might have a real medical emergency. I mean, people have heart attacks and die from overexertion in the Darien Gap. And the kids were struggling, too.
At one point, the toddler fell asleep and wouldn't wake up.
And the family was trying for quite a while to try to get him to wake up. And he was unresponsive. He probably had heat exhaustion. And everybody was getting really nervous.
Eventually, they were able to wake him and give him a little water. But this was just one of many harrowing moments on their journey.
Everybody was operating on very little food, water, and rest, trying to keep putting one foot in front of the other.
The voice you're hearing tell this story is Atlantic staff writer Caitlin Dickerson. She's been covering immigration for nearly a decade and won a Pulitzer Prize in 2023 for her reporting. She recently made 3 trips to the Darien Gap with the photographer Lindsay Adario. They documented the grueling conditions of this passage that, according to the United Nations, more than 800,000 people are estimated to make this year, a more than 50% increase over last year. And children under 5 are the fastest growing group making this crossing. This is such an important article to read this election year, as so many voters say immigration to the United States is among their top issues. But as this piece lays out, not only are our immigration policies not actually deterring people from making the trip, they're contributing to so much suffering and so much death. To start, I asked Caitlin to describe the Darien Gap route and what makes it so treacherous.
It's an incredibly dense and dangerous jungle. So we're talking about one of the rainiest places on Earth. It rains far more often than it doesn't there. And I mentioned flash floods that are a result of that. Very thick foliage, all kinds of trees and bushes. You know, there are times when you're in this jungle, and if you get separated by people you're traveling with by 15 feet, you might feel you're completely alone. You know, I had that experience of looking around and thinking I might have gotten lost. And the people I was with were actually still pretty close by, but I couldn't see them because it was so dense. There are dangerous vipers, there are jaguars and other jungle cats. And, you know, you're climbing mountains and you're crossing rivers that wind back and forth, back and forth. And those can be dangerous even when they're not flooded, you know, when they're not up to your neck, because the current is quite strong and can pretty easily sweep people away and does sweep people away very often, unfortunately.
Wow. How did you even get access to tell this story? I kept thinking as I was reading, I mean, you're describing just unbelievable conditions that people are up against, and you were there with them.
Well, it's important to point out that there are other journalists who've made this journey and done incredible work there and really generously helped me and my colleague, Lindsay Adario, who photographed the story. They helped us a lot and gave us advice on where to go, who to talk to, how to do the best that you can to try to stay safe. Lindsay's spent a couple decades now covering war all over the globe, done lots of embeds with the U.S. military that were very physically grueling. And I was surprised, you know, in the Daring Gap to hear her say she felt like this was the most physically grueling assignment that she'd ever taken on. And so one of the challenges in the Daring Gap is that you're carrying everything that you have with you. For example, there was a long conversation about anti-venom and whether we should try to bring anti-venom. We did, but whether it actually would have worked is unclear because anti-venom requires refrigeration and you can't bring a refrigerator with you, so we put it in a lunch pail. You know, thankfully no one got a snake bite because there are snakes in the Daring Gap that will kill you from one bite. But those are the sorts of things that you're up against and you can obviously only do so much to prepare for.
Wow.
And it should go without saying that I had a lot of resources, right? And the vast majority of people who are doing it have almost nothing, you know, are struggling to scrape together the $300 that they have to pay cartels and smuggling organizations to be able to pass through this jungle, and maybe bringing with them a few cans of tuna, some crackers, a bit of water, but not much at all in the way of real preparation.
You know, I think a lot of people might assume that the people crossing the Darien Gap are from South American countries in particular, and maybe exclusively, but that's not the case, right? Can you tell us about who makes this trip, what we know about who makes this trip?
Yeah, it's such an important point because I find that people are always surprised when I mention to them having met someone from China or from Ethiopia or from India, but just about every habited region of the world is represented in the migrant population in the Darien Gap. Yes, most people there come from Venezuela, Ecuador, and Haiti, countries that are familiar to us in our immigration debate, but there's lots of representation from some of those other countries that I mentioned, whether it's people from northern India who are sick and who face religious persecution or political persecution, people from China who are running from a repressive government. A family I interviewed in the Darien Gap had lost their home because the Chinese government took it, bulldozed it to build a road and left them no recourse. I met people from the Democratic Republic of the Congo and lots of people who are migrating for the second and third time in their lives. Lots of the Haitians who I met in the Darien Gap had been living in Chile, for example, but left when Chile's economy tanked as a result of the pandemic. Leaving them with no work and really increasing xenophobia against migrants in Chile. So they felt like they had to relocate for a second time.
Do we have good record keeping around not just the number of people making this trip, but the number of people who attempt the trip and don't make it?
We do not have good record keeping on the number of people who die in the Darien Gap. That was one of the biggest questions I went into this story with. And the answer is pretty disappointing. So the Panamanian border authorities were open with me about the fact that they know most people who die in the Darien Gap, their bodies disintegrate, they're eaten by animals. They never come out. Those people are never counted officially. The Panamanians do take some bodies out of the jungle, but I found that even the numbers of those people that have been reported by the Panamanian government, they seem to be an undercount. I visited a morgue where some of those bodies go when they leave the jungle, and a hospital director there told me that he, in his hospital alone, would see two or three times the official number of bodies that the Panamanian authorities report in a given year, you know, just in his municipality. So we really don't have enough of a concept of just the vast casualties that this migration is leading to.
You know, you write in the piece, the harder migration is, the more cartels and other dangerous groups will profit and the more migrants will die. Can you tell me the role of cartels in facilitating migration through this route? Like, what's their part in this?
Yeah, there's an academic named Adam Isaacson at the Washington Office on Latin America who I think puts this better than just about anybody else. And he says, you know, when you put into place deterrent policies, you take something that was relatively mundane and normal and you make it scarce and expensive, right? Migration is a prohibition economy, if you will. So when the U.S. has pushed for deterrent policies to discourage everyday Panamanians, for example, from helping people to migrate by taking them on boats up the coast from southern to northern Panama, bypassing the jungle, or helping them organize charter flights to get to the north of the country so that they don't have to cross through the jungle. When those crackdowns have happened, the migration hasn't decreased at all. It's increased because criminal organizations say, okay, well, we know how to move things illicitly. We know there is a demand for this movement, so we'll take over. And then added to all the factors that are fueling global migration right now, you know, conflict and climate change, poverty, instability, add to that is now the profit motives of cartels who want to encourage everybody to migrate because it means more money for them, right? Not just people who feel like they need to migrate, but people who haven't even thought about it until they see advertisements on the internet telling them about a relatively easy trip, you know, something that a lot of people fall for and then find out, obviously, when they arrive that they're in for something entirely different.
Oh, I was really struck by this in your piece, actually. I was surprised to hear that the cartels are basically advertising on TikTok and YouTube, showing how this migratory path could actually be quite easy and sort of underselling the trip in terms of its difficulty and danger to sort of entice people that maybe weren't thinking of migrating, but who might see the advertisement and say, I think I could do that.
You know, the people who work as smugglers informally in the Darien Gap are rolling constantly on their cell phones, and they post videos on the internet selling these trips. And so these videos go up on the internet, and it really varies, you know, the degree to which how many people believe them versus not. A mother I met from Vietnam, she had no idea, and she actually thought she'd be walking on a paved road. A family of a sick migrant who I talked to told me that he was actually told he was going to be put in a helicopter and delivered to the United States that way. So people really do fall for these lies about what it means to cross the jungle. And some of them don't survive. And in both of those cases, actually, that Vietnamese mother lost her 9-year-old son in the jungle. He died. And the young man, the young sick man from India, also never emerged and is presumed by his family to be dead.
While some people are motivated to migrate by these cartel videos, others are well aware of the dangers ahead, but make the trek anyway. That was the case for Burkhan and Orlimar, the Venezuelan family we talked about earlier. When the couple were young, they had no intention of migrating.
They had a fairly comfortable upbringing, and they were middle-class Venezuelans. You know, Orlimar's mother was a nurse. She was studying nursing herself. Burkhan wanted to be an engineer.
Then, in 2014, the Venezuelan economy went into freefall and eventually collapsed.
Right now, the minimum wage for a month of work in Venezuela is about $3. And goods are still expensive. Electricity is inconsistent. Running water is inconsistent. Hospitals are not reliable or safe. Children are dying of malnutrition. And so the future that Orlimar and Burkhan had been working toward, it ceased to exist.
They joined the more than 7 million people who have left Venezuela since 2014. First, they moved to Peru, but they were still struggling there. Then Orlimar's cousin, Elimar, came to them with an offer.
Her boyfriend was living in Dallas and said, I'll pay for you guys to cross the Darien Gap if you help Elimar and her two children do so as well.
So they agreed to it. And while it was difficult, they made it through the Darien Gap. But they still had roughly 2,500 miles ahead of them before they reached the U.S.-Mexico border. It's a long way, made easier if you can pay for some form of transportation. Burkhan and Orlimar didn't have the money.
Elimar, the cousin, had money from her boyfriend who was living in Dallas. Burkhan and Orlimar didn't. You know, he'd given their loan for them to get through the jungle, and that was it. And so Burkhan, at checkpoints and bus stations, would have to stop and try to find ways to make money. And Elimar ran out of patience for waiting.
Elimar secretly bought bus tickets to Mexico City for herself and her kids and didn't tell anyone until they were about to board.
they had a falling out and they still haven't spoken. And, you know, Orlemar and Elimar were raised as sisters, essentially. They were very close all their lives. Just one example, again, of how difficult it can be when people are pushed to the brink of their capabilities.
Elimar and her two children made it to Mexico City and then paid smugglers to take them across the U.S.-Mexico border illegally. They turned themselves in over to border officials, requested asylum status, and are now living on the outskirts of Dallas. Burkhan and Orlemar eventually made it to Mexico City, too, and they're still there today.
Burkhan, Orlemar, and their two children are living in a basement apartment. They're working odd jobs. They have still very little money and are waiting. They've used the app called CBP1 that the Biden administration has been using to try to manage overcrowding at the border, and they've been waiting for an appointment via that application since December.
You mentioned a pretty startling number earlier about the number of people who make this journey who are children. What does that say to you, that there are so many children on this trip?
It's a trend that I've seen again and again, where a new migration path is forged, and initially it's single men who go on their own, who risk trying to make it, seeing if they can, and trying to get work, and then often sending money home for others to follow behind. And so the same has happened here in the Darien Gap. You know, it was predominantly adults and predominantly men for a really long time. And I think part of why you see more women and children now is the role that these smuggling organizations have played. So they're trying to make the Darien Gap more accessible. I mean, there's a dichotomy. It's very dangerous. And yet they're extending the Wi-Fi signal in the Darien Gap. They're sending people into the Darien Gap to sell water and Gatorade, at least on the Colombian side of the border where the Gulf cartel operates. They're moving routes. So I took routes at some point that were older and had been abandoned and were even more physically challenging than the ones that people are taking now. And when I asked, you know, well, why isn't this route being used anymore? The smugglers told me, because you have more women and children. And so we've intentionally moved the route over to try to make it a little bit more accessible, to try to get more people to do it. So I think that's part of why you see so many children, and desperation is setting in, right? I mean, I think I've been asked many times, and one can't help but think it themselves, you know, how do you make the decision to bring a baby into the Darien Gap? And the answer is that very often, whatever these families are leaving behind was worse. You know, that's what they explain. And that's what I heard from migration officials. You know, the UN has stationed people throughout Latin America trying to discourage migrants and warn them of the dangers of the Darien Gap. And a UN migration official I interviewed told me, you know, these folks have tunnel vision. Turning back isn't an option. And a lot of times, you know, as dangerous as the jungle might be, it's not the most challenging thing that they've ever gone through. You know, I mentioned children dying of malnutrition in Venezuela. And so sometimes the choice is between death that feels more certain and the possibility of living. I know that's really hard for a lot of Americans to wrap their minds around, but that's really what you're dealing with in a lot of cases.
Mm. What you're saying is reminding me of this this poem by a Somali British poet. Mm. Her name is Warsan Shire, and it starts with the phrase, "No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark."
You only run for the border when you see the whole city running as well. The boy you went to school with who kissed you dizzy behind the old tin factory is holding a gun bigger than his body. You only leave home when home won't let you stay.
Mm. I mean, it's a beautiful poem, and it's haunting in a lot of ways. It's just about what people flee and why they flee home.
That makes sense to me in that I hear so often, as I mentioned, that people just want to go home. You know, it's not chasing the American dream that sends someone through the Darien Gap in the vast majority of cases. It's a worst case scenario. It's a last resort.
Yeah. I wanted to take a step back here and just talk about the U.S.'s role in all of this and what we understand about the cause and effect of different policies. And you've been covering this topic for many years now. Maybe I can even ask you to do a bit of comparison between Trump administration policies and Biden administration policies. What do we know about how they have affected immigration, the numbers of people making these journeys, and just the type of journeys they're making?
So our foreign policy with regard to Latin America is similar in that both under the Trump administration and now, there's real pressure from the State Department and the Department of Homeland Security to try to discourage migration. But what Biden administration officials emphasize as well is a desire to bring humanitarian resources and do what they can to help keep migrants safe. They call these protection policies, you know, deterrence and protection, and say they're trying to strike a balance between those two things. But what I saw in the Darien Gap is that that is really difficult because, you know, I visited a fishing community in southern Panama that used to be on a migration route. People there told me as long as they could remember, migrants from all over the world arrived, albeit in lower numbers than now, but that everybody in this community in Puerto Obaldía had grown up seeing migrants from all over the world come, and local fishermen would help them out, basically help them get to northern Panama, and the migrants would pay. But when the deterrent policies were first imposed in this community called Puerto Obaldía in 2015, they were pushed by the United States government, which was concerned about an increase in border crossings. These fishermen started to be arrested and charged with human smuggling. Everybody in town was discouraged from ever helping migrants. And what happened next is that the same boat routes north through Panama continued, but cartels took them over. And so now these boat rides take place on a nightly basis. They're considered VIP routes because they do bypass the jungle, but they're still very dangerous. They capsize frequently. More than a dozen people have been confirmed dead this year on those boat routes. And just like with the jungle, those numbers are very likely undercounts. So my reporting in Puerto Obaldía really threw into stark relief for me how difficult it is to have deterrent and protection policies that complement one another. You know, what I saw there was that they actually seem to be working against each other because the deterrent policy created more safety risks rather than the opposite.
Are there any policies that we've seen that have an impact of actually reducing the number of people trying to make this very dangerous trip?
One of the strategies the Biden administration is employing now to try to discourage people from crossing the Darien Gap is what's known as safe mobility offices that they're opening throughout Latin America, where people can go apply for asylum or refugee status, be vetted, and if they're approved, they can fly directly to the United States, which is obviously a lot safer, and sometimes it's even less expensive, too. So they're scaling those offices up very quickly. They told me they hope to do 50,000 approvals this year, which is far more than we've seen in the past. But compare that to more than 523,000 people who crossed the Darien Gap last year. And you can see that it's a drop in the bucket. So there's a hope that that type of initiative, as well as the CBP One app that we talked about, will try to create avenues for people that allow them to bypass having to work with criminal organizations or put their lives at risk. And I think it will just be a question of numbers, you know, whether the word gets out enough and whether there are enough slots to satisfy the need. It doesn't seem that there will be, but that's what the government is shooting for, at least right now.
Along with covering immigration, I know you've also covered the last several presidential races. We've heard former President Donald Trump on the campaign trail talking a lot about his border policies and saying that illegal immigration into the U.S. plummeted under his watch. Can you fact check him and what he's been saying?
It didn't. So there's been a lot of discussion of the fact that migration has been record-breaking under the Biden administration, which is true, but it's also the case that the previous record is held by the Trump administration. So following, you know, the very harsh deterrent policies that went into place in his first 2 years in office, 2017, 2018, including the family separations, border crossings in 2019 exceeded 1 million people. The complexity there, and I think the number that Trump is trying to fudge comes from the COVID-19 pandemic and the use of Title 42, which was a policy that immediately turned asylum seekers around at the border, basically made asylum inaccessible to them because of, at least in the name of the policy, because of the pandemic, though it was really, you know, an immigration policy. And my reporting showed that the motivation was always based on migration and not on public health. Under Title 42, asylum was unavailable initially to everybody, later after court challenges, unavailable to single adults, and it was made available again to children and families. But you still had large numbers of people crossing the border by evading border authorities, you know, crossing illegally. And you had lots of people who were finding other ways to make it into the United States, people who qualified for other forms of protection, like under the Convention Against Torture, for example. So, you know, Trump's time in office is not an exception when it comes to this history of deterrent policies that make things really difficult for people, but that don't actually serve the interests of Americans who want to see either less migration or more orderly migration.
Do we know, I mean, based on polling, what do the majority of Americans want to see happen at the border? What's the priority?
So it's complicated. An increasing number of Americans are citing immigration as an important issue. It's now the most cited issues, number one concern for voters. But then you also have most Americans saying that they think people living in the United States without legal status should be able to legalize. You have, I believe, a little more than half the country saying that they feel sympathy toward people coming to the United States. So these are some of the broad questions pollsters ask that don't give us a whole lot of specificity. You know, the way that I analyze all these questions and the data that I've seen in response to them is that you do have most Americans concerned now about disorder at the border and looking for a solution. Of course, there is disagreement about what that solution should look like. You know, should we have a more permissive policy or should we have less? But I think the thing that everyone agrees on is come up with solutions that actually make sense and seem to serve American interests better. And, you know, for some people, they also would like for those policies to serve the interests of migrants and refugees and asylum seekers better as well.
You know, it sort of feels like, I mean, we've been hearing former President Trump attacking Vice President Harris's record on border issues. She, at a recent campaign rally, said Trump-backed Republicans tanked a bipartisan border security bill earlier this year and kind of put the onus back on him. It feels like both Democrats and Republicans are sort of trying to out-border security each other in this race so far, in this campaign so far. But what do you see happening? What do you see being, what productive conversations do you see happening around border security policy?
Yeah, I mean, trying to out-border security one another, I do think, is the right characterization. I think Democrats do have a bit of a leg to stand on with regard to Trump in that, you know, he did really torpedo bipartisan negotiations during his presidency, as well as bipartisan negotiations that were taking place under the Biden administration, which led a lot of people to ask, you know, do you really want to address border issues or do you actually just want this crisis to continue so that you can point to it as a campaign issue? To answer your question about productive conversations, there aren't a lot happening. When I talk to congressional staffers, and as I've spoken to them about this issue for just about the last decade, they usually start by saying, you know, it's not likely, you know, not likely to see reform this year. But I do think that the fact that more and more Americans are latching onto this issue as a concern and learning about it, learning, you know, the complexities and the machinations of it. I think it's putting more pressure on the government to do something. We know there would be major policy changes instituted if Trump were to win the election this year. And I think it's very likely that if he were to lose and Vice President Kamala Harris were to win, that we would also see some kind of change just because of how overwhelming the pressure has become. Mm.
I thought maybe in our last few minutes, I could ask you to end on a story that you also ended your piece on. It feels appropriate to end your piece on it because it does feel like it sort of touches on so many of the different themes that you were discovering in this reporting. Can I ask you to just end on the story of a Vietnamese woman you met named Bé, who lost her son while making this journey through the Darien Gap?
Yeah. So when I got out of the Darien Gap and I arrived in Bajo Chiquito, the indigenous community we talked about, I saw a couple of signs posted on the sides of houses with a picture of a child and a phone number and a message that they were searching for information. And so when I left Panama, I contacted the phone number, and it turned out to be the boy's mother, Bé Thi Le, who was from Vietnam, as you mentioned. She'd worked as a school administrator. She was a single mother to her son, Khan. And her story is important for a lot of reasons. One of them is that she's someone who probably wouldn't have come to the Darien Gap at all if it were not for the videos posted online by smugglers that she'd seen advertising a much easier journey. She lost her job during the pandemic. She was very poor, you know, but surviving. But because she and Khan were struggling and she saw the Darien Gap, or what she thought the Darien Gap looked like as a way out, family in the United States sent her money, and she and Khan set out to join them. They took the same route that I did at one point, and only about a week after me, and they were crossing a river when there was a flash flood. They knew because the water had been clear and all of a sudden it turned brown, and neither Bé or Khan knew how to swim, but again had taken this journey because they didn't know that it involved swimming. And Bé reached out to grab onto a boulder to steady herself. They were linking arms with a man from Ecuador named Juan, all helping each other across the river. Mm-hmm. But Juan was wearing a backpack and it filled with water. This happens a lot in the Darien Gap, and it dragged him under. And when that happened, he lost hold of Khan. So when Bé and Juan looked out in the direction that Khan had drifted away, he was gone. Mm-hmm. Bé told me that she scrambled to the beach on the other side of the river and felt all of the energy drain from her body. She just sat there frozen and catatonic, and the people she'd been traveling with basically gave her their condolences and kept walking. Eventually, Juan encouraged her, convinced her to keep going and report what had happened to authorities in Panama. They did not indicate that they planned to look for Khan. They discouraged Bé from doing so. And since then, she's really struggled because, like so many people who lose loved ones in the Darien Gap, she doesn't have a body to mourn. She doesn't have a child to mourn. And so she's become obsessed with this idea that maybe Khan survived and was rescued and maybe he's looking for her. Mm. And because I had contacted her and, you know, told her that I would tell her story as part of my reporting on the Darien Gap, that I would speak with American authorities about what happened with the International Committee of the Red Cross, which does have a program that sometimes successfully reunites families with migrants who are lost, you know, whether they're alive or dead. They do manage to do it sometimes. And because she knew I was having those conversations, Bé started writing to me all the time and still does, you know, will you help me find my baby? Please help me find my son. What do you think has happened to my son? One of the last messages she sent to me was, I'm always waiting for news of my baby. Mm.
Thank you for this very human and very on-the-ground reporting. I think it's really important to hear these stories of just the experience, the very grueling experience of what it's like for a lot of these people making this journey.
I think so too. Thank you so much. I'm grateful to be able to talk about it.
You can read Caitlin Dickerson's piece for The Atlantic and see photos taken by the photographer Lindsay Addario on Apple News. We'll include a link for you on our show notes page. And if you're listening in the News app, we've queued up that story to play for you next.